Trusting that the microphone is working?
No, you have to get closer.
Okay. We'll try again. Yeah, that sounds better. Welcome, everyone. Delighted to have you all here. There are people still coming in, so we'll be finding seats for the new arrivals, but we should get things kicked off. I'm going to start by just stating for the record that today is Wednesday, April 11th, 2018. It is 3 p.m. here in Boulder, and this is panel number 3306, entitled The Many Forms of Capitalism. I will encourage you to, if you haven't already, excuse me, my voice is a little hoarse, to read thoroughly the bios of our panelists today. It's a remarkable group of people. To my left is Peter Light, and then we have Larry Greenwood. We have Jose de la Fuente and Martha Goss at the end of the table. And I read their bios with admiration and awe, but am also struck by, in addition to their experience, international experience in business, banking, investment, there is such a variety. Thank you. I will respond to those raised hands. Such a variety of other experience, philanthropic and even diplomatic, in this group. The topic is intriguing. I am among you, I suspect, in being totally intrigued by where this topic will go. Very quickly, my name is Paul Jury. My career was in quite a diversity of early stage, generally public, private, technology-based companies. I was then the director of an entrepreneurship program here at CU for about 9 years, in addition to being pretty firmly planted in businesses in the center of capitalism. I also was on the board of the Unreasonable Institute and currently an advisor to the Watson University Scholars, as well as to the Global Social and Sustainable Enterprise Program, graduate program up at CSU. So the use of business to really foster economic development around the world is a passion. With that, I would like to say that we will be later, of course, having, and we're looking to moving toward a Q&A session here fairly quickly, but we will start with prepared remarks. And in this democratic society, I'm going to ask for a show of hand. The first hand to go up will be the first speaker today.
It's going to be a little bit.
Let's go down the line.
Down the line, then. It's such a good system, Peter. Thank you.
Paul doesn't know what horse is. I'll do my best to be heard. I have a real problem with taxonomy and the expression capitalism, just to begin with, because of the world that we live in. And I'd like to give you just an example of the topsy-turvy nature of our world. When I was looking after J.P. Morgan in Beijing during the financial crisis, I was called by the head regulator on the phone, and I was very frightened because I was the legal signatory for the bank in China. So if anything went wrong with anyone or anywhere in the bank, I was going to the slammer. So I didn't know what to expect. And he was an old friend of mine. And he said to me, "Can you help me form a labor union?" So I said, "Well, you know, I'm the running dog of capitalism, and you're the commie bastard. So what's going on here?" So that just sets the stage for my discomfort with terms. I went to a dictionary and I looked up capitalism, free enterprise, market economy, free market, have it any way you'd like. And then I started thinking about unfettered capitalism, and then my mind sort of wandered to the robber barons. And I wondered if are we witnessing an ascendance of a new robber baron class of the 1%. And they really were capitalists who acquired fortunes through ruthless means and probably the abuse of capitalism. And their power was clearly derived from wealth. And it was originally used, the notion was used to describe feudal lords who were engaged in plundering. The term was first used for Cornelius Vanderbilt. To me, free market does not mean a thumb on the scale in any fashion. So an attack on Amazon, and I'm defending Amazon, an attack on Amazon because people in power have problem with the management who have interest in newspapers, I find very disturbing. And I assure you, this is not what Adam Smith had in mind when he talked about the invisible hand. We also have to deal with the confluence of brilliance and capitalism as we try to grapple now with Facebook. I think we really all have to think about that. And I would urge you, I don't know if you heard the exchange last night between Senator Durden from Illinois and Mark Zuckerberg. It was priceless. It's an aside, there were these old guys, these old farts who don't know anything about technology, shooting their faces off. And Dick Durden says to Zuckerberg, "Do you mind sharing with us where you slept last night?" And he said, "No, I'd rather not." And then Durden said, "I think, what did you do for the last two nights?" Or something like that. And clearly that's what it really boiled down to. But that's an aside. I just couldn't help passing that on. And I was also thinking about now sort of the role models for a capitalistic America and the company that we're insinuating ourselves into. And I look at Russia, and I look at China, and I look at Saudi Arabia, and I look at Turkey. And I think about the one thing that they all have in common. There's this mantra in all of these societies that they fear instability. And I find that the fear of instability and chaos can trigger tendencies away from capitalism and towards authoritarianism. And I wonder why we are casting our lot with societies that are in conflict, not only with our own moral values, but with our own economic values. And I would suggest that capitalism cannot simply be the survival of the fittest, because at the end of the day, I think we are all of a community. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll be actually more positive about capitalism and just confess right up front that one of the more influential books in my life when I was going through college 40 some years ago was Freedom and Capitalism by Milton Friedman. Right. So I mean, capitalism we shouldn't forget. And actually, maybe it's ironic because I do agree with a lot of what Peter just said. Capitalism is actually relatively new. It only came out in the last couple of centuries. It grew very much in parallel with the increase of pluralism and the breakdown of feudal systems in Western Europe. Initially the first a slave economy and then a serfdom economy was what we saw in the Roman Empire and in Western Europe. That developed over time, and capitalism is one of the things that came out of that very much in parallel with the development of pluralism and eventually democracy. So capitalism and freedom, democracy, have in the past been very closely associated. And when we see what has happened in terms of when countries have gone from, and I define capitalism maybe a little bit more narrowly, which is that it's the private ownership of the factors of production, free labor markets, and ability to earn and keep wealth, that has been obviously economically a very successful system. And when you saw countries like China who abandoned a communist system of mainly state ownership, and also the Soviet Union of state ownership, and move towards capitalism. Obviously, those weren't unfettered. Well, in some ways, unfettered to unfettered capitalism. Then you saw massive growth. And so I would say that the application of markets or the use of freer markets in China is responsible for a lot of that, the economic success of that country. Again, as I mentioned the other day, pulling hundreds and hundreds of millions of Chinese out of poverty. Obviously, unfettered capitalism with no regulation is will never work. And capitalism requires obviously a lot of conditions. One being a rule of law. That's an important part. If you're an investor and you're or a businessman and you're investing in a business and risking, taking risks to do business, and that you that you have to be assured that you're going to get and be able to keep those profits. That wasn't the case in feudal Europe. If farmers tilled the land and had to give the product to the lord, so that rule of law, property rights, protection of property rights, strong institutions are required. And then later on, as we as developed capitalism, Peter mentioned the robber barons of the late 19th century in the United States. It was very clear that with capitalism came concentration of business, because economies of scale were very effective, that concentration then led to abuses, and therefore we have antitrust law to ensure that there's going to be competition within the marketplace. So clearly antitrust law is required to make an effective free market work. And then there's safety, there's protections against fraud. I came most recently from the financial sector, and Martha will talk about this, I'm guessing, in more detail. But the financial sector clearly has to be properly regulated. I was working for an insurance company, and in fact, we loved regulation, because without regulation, we'd have a bunch of frankly shady competitors running around, getting premiums from customers and never paying off on the policies. And that hurt our business, not only because we can't compete against shady competitors, because they undermine the credibility of insurance, which is that you're going to pay somebody in 20, 30 years, or you're going to pay their heirs. So regulation of that sector was really important for us, proper regulation. And then the question is, and then you have different forms of regulation, different forms of capitalism, depending on how much state ownership that you're interested in having versus private ownership. I mean, there's no purely capitalist country in the world, including the United States. How much regulation you want, how much you're going to be protecting labor. Free labor market is important, but at the same time, you know, how much do you protect people who get laid off, for example, is a question that, you know, it's a continuum that you can do. If we have some countries like the United States where there's, or maybe within the United States, you have some states where there's not much protection for unemployment. In the state that I live in, there's very large, the protection for unemployment is very high. Compensation for unemployment is high. My son got laid off, and he didn't work for the entire year, but he got his compensation, and then the day the compensation stopped, he started looking for work again. It's that generous, which is maybe too generous. And there's a variance. And then you have, you know, if you look at different countries, you obviously see different variants of capitalism as well. The U.S., again, more a bit freer, more individual responsibility. The example I know best is Japan, outside of the United States, is Japan, which is a very interesting form of capitalism in the sense that there's many more protections for the weak and for the vulnerable. At the same time, there's not a lot. They also allow a lot less competition in the marketplace, which there's a price to pay for that. There's a lot of labor protections. At the same time, that means that companies hire fewer people. And France has the same problem. So, you know, these choices you have to make and decide as a society what choice you want. But there's, I'm an economist, so I have to say there's no such thing as a free lunch. There's always a price to pay for whatever choice you make. And so, you know, the variants of capitalism kind of fall along that continuum of how much regulation you want and how much state ownership you want. I think an interesting question, which I'd like to just kind of throw out, I don't have an answer, is are we now coming up to a new form of capitalism or a new way to look at the economy, given the kind of new economic trends that we're seeing? And by that I mean the explosion of the gig economy, where labor is no longer kind of in a market situation, but people are being hired individually. They don't go into companies. They work on an outsourced basis. Whether it's Uber or it could be any large company, again, outsourcing is being done much greater basis, where you have a disintermediation of the normal financial institutions through fintech. So you don't need as an individual, you can actually start a business. You can get your financing through crowdfunding over the internet. You don't have to go through a usual financial institution, and do your business without actually ever hitting a corporation. You have data flows that are now. I mean, is data a new factor of factor of production? Is data like going to be like land and labor and capital? Does that have a special value now that needs to be kind of factored into economic thinking with regard to how we run capitalist systems? And then I would say the networking effect that Peter just mentioned, the fact that with the rise of social media, you have a new kind of concentration. We had Standard Oil back in the late 19th century. Now we have this new concentration where the more people sign on to Facebook, the more competitive it becomes, the more difficult it is to rival that competition. And what does that mean, particularly when there's really no abuse of dominant power that you can see? I mean, there's the secrecy and stuff like that, but there's no competitive abuse. That's obvious. There can be some. For example, you can have search results that favor your own product versus a competitor. That's actually easy. The impact of having network effect, having large companies like Facebook and Google out there, just being big, it's just being big bad. So, because the way we look at antitrust, big isn't necessarily bad. Big is bad when you do bad things. And so those are new questions that we really haven't wrestled with. So my question is, are we now approaching a new kind of capital? Do we need a new kind of capitalism? Do we need a new kind of approach to think about a very different economy? Last thing, AI, artificial intelligence and the impact on the labor markets of that, does that require a new way of thinking about capitalism? Thank you.
Good afternoon. I think we have described already what capitalism really means. I think that, in summary, it's a free market economy to succeed and based on the laws of supply and demand. I think that based on the additional definitions that have been discussed earlier. But I think there's one plus on this is the results in the best products for the best price. That would be the most consumption, based on consumption, that would be probably the best definition. But then obviously it doesn't provide for those that are less competitive and have less skills to participate in the economy. So I think there's a social factor there that capitalism doesn't really look at. I think that one of my best definitions of capitalism is based on the book of Ayn Rand, which he mentions, capitalism is a social system based on recognition of individual rights, including property rights, in which all property is privately owned. And basically expands that to the concept of the only system that stood for man's right in his own mind, to his work, to his life, to his happiness, to himself. So I think that's a good definition, but it's also a little selfish because I think that today, we're a very gregarious economy, and every day more if we take into account all the social media and how connected we all are. So looking at a model on how capitalism can be sort of tamed down, we look at what some of the European countries are based on, and this is a German model, what's called the social market economy, which I think has been applied, and me being from Chile and work extensively in Latin America, I think that the level of true capitalism has to be measured also by the idiosyncrasy of our citizens, our people. I think all these countries, we all have different levels of development, so we need different things. And there's no one solution just fits all. And today, everything is more customized. I mean, we don't like a sneaker, we change the color on the internet, and we'll have a sneaker that's different from everybody else. So if we take that to policies, to requirements, to our populations, definitely goes beyond that. So based on that model of the social market economy, really we need to have a coordinated economy. And I think that we also need to add ethics to this. Me being a Catholic, I think, always is good to have Catholic ethics. Each one has different beliefs. But I think that one of the things that religion brings to everyone, whatever it has it, is some sort of ethics that rules the way and the rules the game. So capitalism without the word ethics, adding morality to it, it's a tough situation. And then I think that also it doesn't allow for governments to cover issues like unemployment, housing, poverty, sickness, disability, the elderly, and specifically in countries like Latin America, where you know people don't have a good pension fund, and once they're retired, they really have nowhere to live or any sustainability. It also supports the, or it will support, or it can support, and it should support the ability for less privileged to have a better education. And I think that at the end, in Latin America, I think every day more, each countries are realizing that the need for education is really what's going to drive our countries in the future, and in the way that we can have better prepared people ready to compete globally is key, because otherwise we're going to continue to be underdeveloped. So I think it's a role of government, and I think it's a way of redistributing the wealth is bringing it to education. And finally, I think that obviously when this support becomes too extensive, it's expensive. You know, I was looking at in France to support, you know, being one of the social market economy examples. I mean, 33% of the GDP of France is dedicated to all the social welfare health programs they have. 33% of GDP. That's unsustainable. I mean, who's going to pay for that? If we bring back to Australia, Switzerland, and the U.S., it's close to 20%. Okay. And you still see that it's not sufficient to support, I mean, you guys, social security system here in the States is broken. So how are they going to sustain it just with 20% of your GDP? So think if you give that burden to countries in Latin America. I mean, that's totally unsustainable. So I don't have the solution, but I think that really what I'm bringing up is an idea of, you know, we really need to have be a believer in free economy. I lived through the communist government of Allende in Chile in 1970 through 1973. I was, you know, a teenager at that time. But I do remember just going from a place where I could just go into every store and buy whatever I wanted to have to stand in line in the morning at 5 o'clock in the morning to buy your breakfast bread. You know, something like Venezuela is going through right now. So going from this very social economy that everything's the same, I mentioned this in a prior panel, I think just like Margaret Thatcher did, socialism just levels everything down, and we really need to have an economy that levels things up and improves the well-being of our citizens and our population. I think capitalism with some taming is the right solution and is the right way, because it's key that everybody knows that whatever they save money to buy a house, that house is theirs and is going to be their kids, and is going to it's a private property that's going to be a private asset that's going to be held generation to generation. So that's key, and that's part of this capitalist model. So I think with that, you know, I think in Latin America, really capitalism is key for the development of our economies, but it needs to be tamed, and it needs to be somewhat sweetened with an intervention in the state that allows them to support all these issues that we discussed, like education and everything else. And what is the problem today? The problem is that today, in Latin America, corruption is a key thing that we see every day in government. So obviously, that creates a bigger burden for this to happen, because people don't believe in their institutions. The Social Security is as corrupt as in any other developed country. We have very weak democracies. You know, we go from left to right in 4 years. So obviously, there's no master plan that can be followed. So that makes it even harder. And you know, the levels of institutionality of our institutions are definitely all weak, because this government is weak. You know, we just changed governments in Chile, and 20,000 people were fired, you know, just because they were political jobs. So how can any ministry follow in their policies? And before that, you know, 4 years before that, other 15,000 people was fired. So with that having strong institutions and a master plan that allows for this to follow through, it's hard to bring that up. And I would just finish that, you know, basically we're also economies that are very based on commodities. So obviously, you know, we had to add a little more spice to this whole soup, is that obviously, you know, the economy of the world, the first thing hit are commodities. So makes our whole economic system very unstable. So by having better education, have people develop different industries, entrepreneurship, is going to allow us to move away from commodity-based economies. And hopefully, you know, unfortunately, Mr. Trump decided not to go to Latin America. So it's just another reason the United States is not participating in the development of our region. But fortunately, China is participating actively. Asia, I mean, other countries in Asia, like Korea as well, and Europe, European countries, specifically Spain, is actively participating too. So there's opportunities there, and I think that you all should push for United States to be part of that. I mean, we're all one continent, so we should all be partners in this. Thank you.
Well, I'll key off a little bit of what Larry had to say, because, I'm going to focus more on the U.S., although I'll talk about some others. The U.S. is a very interesting history of capitalism, and I look at it as cycles where we're very entrepreneurial, we create, you know, a strong economy, and then we have a big bubble, and then it blows up. And every time it blows up, we end up with more regulation. And I'm not against regulation. I spent most of my entire career in regulated industries. I had a wonderful course in business school that was all about regulation and how you can't have unfettered competition. You know, if you go back to the Charles Darwin approach of, you know, survival of the fittest, it is something you've got to protect, as all of the speakers have said. You've got to protect the weaker parts of the economy, the people who, for whatever reason, don't have the proper education, have disabilities, don't have social mobility to move to areas where they can get a better job. There are all sorts of things that you have to provide safety nets for. But I think it's really interesting if you look at the, you know, again, these cycles where we've gone through, you know, just a booming economy, and then something happens. It's always something that triggers it. Something happens, and we go into a crash, and everybody runs for the hills and says, it's all about regulation. And it's not all about regulation, although, again, that's an important element that people really need to think through. Larry and I were talking about, to some degree, about the, you know, the most recent, the Great Recession. That obviously came about because there were huge excesses in the system, and everybody was trying to profit from primarily from the mortgage market, the property market, and there was a lack of regulation. There was an excessive lack of regulation of some of the particularly non-bank financial institutions, because the banks, by and large, did have proper regulation. You could argue that they didn't have proper regulation over some of their mortgage-backed security deals, but that, I mean, we could spend an hour talking about mortgage-backed securities and what failed and what
Let's
didn't.
Let's not.
Oh, it's a fascinating topic.
I know.
But it's a good example where there were marginal players in the business who, for whatever reason, just didn't get scrutinized. And those marginal players were, frankly, the ones that ultimately blew up the bubble and blew up the markets. So now we're trying to figure out how do we have to regulate the financial services industry. And I'm not a great fan of Dodd-Frank. And to be fair, I don't think Dodd-Frank has accomplished what they thought they were going to accomplish. And it's not clear it's particularly good regulation. I was having a conversation with somebody the other day about the SEC. And the SEC is a very important regulatory body in terms of regulating, you know, our capital markets, regulating companies and the way that they market their securities. But historically, the SEC has been underfunded. They actually have made a lot of money for the Treasury because they have, in fact, collected substantial fines from lots of people. But that money does not go back into regulation. It kind of amorphously goes back into the U.S. Treasury, and who knows where that goes. So, again, I think we probably, and I don't think it's going to happen under this administration, but we really need to look at our regulatory structures, our regulatory bodies, and try to find the balance. Because inevitably what we do is when we go into a bubble, we end up with, a blow-up, and then we way over-regulate. And that's part of the reason we have as much of a recession as we often do. If you go back to the 1970s, and this is an issue that I am very concerned about looking forward, given some of the statistics you were talking about with Social Security and recent numbers on the federal budgets and the federal deficit. What happened in the 1970s was that the federal government, interest rates, as you may recall, went through the roof. The federal government was basically taking over or just crowded out the, in the capital markets, crowded out private borrowers. and it was something that they called stagflation. And I'm sure some of you in this audience, I can tell by the color of the hair, have been there for stagflation and understand what that did to this country. It took out an entire decade of financial growth in this country. The 1970s were just a dead decade. And it was because the federal deficit had grown and the interest rates were forced into a higher level, the federal government had to borrow, and it crowded out the private borrowers. And I am extremely concerned that that is going to be something we will be facing this country in the next 5 to 10 years, if not sooner. So again, I think, you know, regulation, I'm a fan of regulation to a point, but it's such a seesaw. And so I'll use that as a comparison to, for instance, China, which I don't know if Peter will agree with me on this, but I have a former boss of mine who's done a lot of work in investments in Asia and particularly in China. And historically, at least meaning the last 15, 20 years, he's loved investing in China because the markets are predictable. And if not predictable, that's probably not the right word, but there's a vision, there's a plan. It's not at sort of the whim of sort of the markets, quote unquote. And in fact, there's always this expectation until fairly recently that the Chinese were controlling their economy. Again, I don't know if you want to agree or disagree with me on that one, but it's been a good investment market for that reason.
Nothing like the lack of a free market.
Exactly.
No, and it also causes terrible problems for the government because as soon as widows and orphans start investing and the market goes down, there's a panic in China.
Yeah. Well, and China obviously has had other issues in terms of, you know, people coming to the cities and not having enough housing, and, you know, it's disrupted their economy in all sorts of ways, particularly on the social level. But as an investor, it's been a somewhat predictable market until fairly recently. The other thing I was going to react to your comment about, you know, the social net, particularly in Europe, but particularly in France. And I agree with you. It's interesting that Macron is actually addressing that and is trying to reduce the issues there. I've seen this in some of the companies I work with. The social net, it used to be that when you were fired from a French company, if they could fire you at all, it would be at least 2 or 3 years of severance or longer. And now they're trying to reduce that. And I give Macron a lot of credit. He's fighting an uphill battle, but that's something that, again, there's this balance between social net and being able to have an economy that isn't clogged by these regulations that prevent the growth in the economy. So I don't know if I have a lot more to add. I think the other panelists have highlighted the key issues. I think what's interesting is to sort of see how technology, changes in technology, have driven, whether it's capitalism or whether you would just want to call it economic growth. You were talking about data. I think of data as a product. It's definitely, and it's certainly being used as a product at this point in time. It's another asset, whether you put it on your balance sheet or not. I mean, I'm pretty certain most people are not putting data on their balance sheet. But it is another asset and needs to be valued, if not just as an intangible. It needs to be valued as what is the value and what does the company, you know, how does the company collect the data? I mean, we're talking about this right now with Facebook. How does the company collect the data and who owns the data and who should be paid for the data? So I think there's a number of really interesting issues there. I love the idea of artificial intelligence. There's augmented reality. I attended the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas this year, and it's just overwhelming. I mean, it's kind of hard to get your head around all this sort of stuff. But all of these are going to have a major impact on how our economy works. And some of the other issues that were brought up, another big theme these days is the whole theme about the future of work. This whole business of the gig economy, people don't have full-time jobs. They may have part-time jobs, but if that's the case, how do you take care of them? They don't have benefits. Obamacare didn't work so well, and it's kind of in limbo at this point in time. And that's a big issue for people who have part-time jobs. They don't have access to health insurance. They don't have access to pensions. And we've done an abysmal job in this country with financial literacy and training people how to think about their current financial requirements and their future financial requirements and how to save. Given the fact that all of us are likely to live at least 10 or 20 years longer than our parents or longer, and we're still retiring people at 65. I don't know if you know where the age 65 retirement age came from. It was from Bismarck in Germany in the late 1800s because they figured most people wouldn't live past 65, so that was a good retirement age. And we still think of that as a proper retirement age. Although I would say that I'm sure all of you know I'm over 65, and I certainly plan to be working for another 5 or 10 years. And I'm sure all of you know people who do, because either they like to work and or they need to work, or it's a combination. So I think, you know, thinking about capitalism, what I think is most interesting is how it evolves with the requirements of the society, of the requirements of the economy, you know, what's the, and I think your point was really good, that the different countries and different value systems have a different approach to capitalism based on what their value system is and what their economic requirements are. So I think it's really interesting to see how it's all evolved, but I think we're going to be facing huge change over the next 5 or 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be exciting, but I also think it's going to be highly disruptive. And we need to come up with better policies, better social structures, better regulatory environment to be able to manage this going forward.
Thank you very much. I think we're doing well on time. We're going to turn to Q&A here in just a moment. I am going to ask the panelists if any of them would like to comment on things, ideas that were generated, or responses, ideas about some of their other panelist comments. But I do want to say that we are obviously taking questions. I do have a laptop open and am getting some questions here. We also have people, I believe, with cards and pencils for those that would like to write their questions down and have them brought up. I encourage you to do that. And if you are a student, please so note that you will be given priority on your question being asked or being submitted to the panel. With that, if I can, I'll go back to the panel again and ask you if any of the ideas and comments that were made have spawned some other or further thoughts.
Two quick comments. I have to say that I'm much relieved that Jose ended his comments by talking about ethics and began his comments with Ayn Rand, because so we agree that she was a better novelist than economist.
Yes. Okay. She was a philosopher.
Quite. Okay. The other thing that I think should, we chatted about this before, that I think is really important when we talk about regulation. Before the financial crisis, the investment banks, of which Lehman Brothers was one, were not regulated. The commercial banks were. So it's not as though the Wild West was abroad on Wall Street. It was abroad in terms of the investment banks. So after the financial crisis and after Lehman Brothers went down the tubes, all the investment banks were regulated for the first time. It's an important distinction to make. That's it.
They became commercial banks. They
Correct.
Had to be converted to commercial
Absolutely.
Banks.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Anything else, panelists? Other comments? With that, then, I would like to suggest, if we're all ready, that we turn to Q&A from the audience.
Yep.
And I do have some, again, you can submit on the app, or we are bringing cards around. Let me start with one here. We're talking about the topic of regulation. One of the questions is, how can we best incorporate full cost accounting to address both climate change and 500 years of institutional oppression? I think the broader, and I'll opine on this, I think that the broader question
over to you.
is the general topic of externalities. How do we create a balance of regulation that will cause companies, corporations, to do a better job of capturing their externalities and taking responsibility for them? But I would love to have the panel opine on that.
Well, I made a comment similar on this topic the other day. Unfortunately, we're going the wrong direction at this point on this. You know, carbon credits are something that have been tried several times. They sort of work. The concept is a good idea, but it doesn't really work. And it is difficult. I mean, back in the 70s when they enacted a lot of pollution requirement bills, there was a lot of hue and cry about the cost of the pollution equipment. But it's driven technology to develop more efficient energy production. So it does work in the long run, but it's not something that's so cut and dry that you can say, if I do A, B, and C, I'm going to get to this point. Because there are a lot of unintended consequences when you put in something like this, and I don't want to denigrate economists, but economists have great ideas about how these things will work, but socially they don't always work the way they're intended.
Anyone else? Jose?
Go ahead.
I think being, having worked for my last 10 years in a consumer products company, I think that, obviously government can tax and devote that money to do that job. But I think that, a lot of companies try to become socially responsible and really work their way to do that. You know, I made this example of Patagonia because it's something close to my business. But I think that the key thing is that I think there's consumer awareness. I think that, in companies that I work with, we've tried to, we make products with recycled paper labels, recycled paper packaging, or try to minimize packaging. That at the end is a little more expensive. But the consumer is not willing to pay that. So really, Boulder is a very special community, because everybody's very aware of the environment here, and it's a very green community. But that's, a needle in a haystack. And really the issue is that today, the H&Ms and the Zaras of the world and the fashion world, they don't really care. And really people just care to buy stuff cheap. So, really I think that everybody has to ante up and really play the game. So if you want companies to be socially responsible and really start worrying about these things, you guys need to be ready to pay for it. And maybe, it's one thing, I think it's better to give it to the enterprise, which can actually show to you what they're doing, that ended up paying through taxes, where you don't know if that money is going to go into corruption or some other ways that is going to be diverted from the true meaning of the program. So,
as an economist, I strongly support the premise of the question, which is that we should be charging for the cost of the environmental damage that's done when you're producing a product, because obviously the environmental harm is a cost to society that the company is not taking on. They're essentially getting a free ride if they're able to put their pollution into a pool. So they should be required to either not do that, or if they're doing, I'm a very strong advocate of a carbon tax. I mean, the climate change is a cost for society that's not being charged to the companies or the consumers. And I think Jose is exactly right. Companies should be required to cover that cost, and it will get passed to the consumers. That's what should happen. But you can't say that it's responsibility for the companies to do it. It's got to be governments directing them to do it. I think it's very dangerous to try to socialize or require companies to take on social responsibilities without requiring them to do that. Let me say that differently. You can't expect them to take on a social role without requiring it. So I believe in CSR, social corporate responsibility, as something that's good for a company. But if you really want a company to do a public role, then you've got to either financially incent them to do it or mandate them to do it. It's not fair to force them to take on a social problem. This is a big issue in Japan, where essentially for decades after the war, the companies were, the part of the implicit deal was that companies would keep people on for life, would ensure full employment, and in exchange, the government would protect them from foreign competition. That actually was maybe a great deal for workers in the beginning, but it ended up being a disaster for the Japanese economy. So that kind of implicit deal doesn't work. It needs to be transparent, and you need to, to be clear about that the externalities have to be factored into the price of a product.
I am receiving numerous questions here, so I'm going to keep trying to move through those. Some of the questions by nature of category, I think, would be particularly well placed to individual members of the panel. I'm hoping, I know some have to leave and move quickly to another event, but for those that can stay, I think there would be some productive discussions to have. Here's one. I am a student. How can capitalism exist in a country that has isolationist policies?
It's deja vu all over again. If you read a bit of history, if you read about America prior to the Roosevelt administration, if you take out the names and you take out the dates, you could be reading the same playbook. I think we have to find a way of getting through it and coming to grips with the fact that it's wrong. And the world is globalist now. We can't hide, nor should we hide. So I think, might I suggest that you vote?
And my Twitter comment on that is that if you mean by isolationism, protectionism is just crony capitalism. It's just allowing companies to go in and put tariffs on to help their shareholders at the expense of the middle class. And so to that degree, it is not compatible.
Bingo.
Anyone else? Sorry, my screen is jumping. I love technology, but there are a number of questions from students generally having to do with how does the future look, and I'll read this one. I'm a student. How do you foresee Gen Z and millennials leading a new capitalism as boomers retire?
Well, presumably they're a lot more tech savvy than our generation is. And hopefully they will be able to employ those technologies to solve some of the problems that we have not solved, both social problems, but also just just the overall things like the environment or social or the economy. How do we make it work more productively? I think that's the challenge. I was saying to somebody, saying in one of my talks the other day, technology is neutral. It's how it's used. And I think that's the thing people have to think about. What are the ethical uses? What are the social uses? What are the environmental impacts? But the challenge for the next generation would be you've got this plethora of amazing new technologies. How do you employ them to improve everybody's life?
And disrupt.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid to disrupt. Because that's what you need to do. Don't think like we think. Take risks and disrupt the system.
I just wanted to add that I think it's key that Generation Y, Generation Z, they all become involved, because I think youth today are not involved enough. I think if we see, what's going, Facebook is going through in Congress, the guys interviewing this guy have no idea what he's talking about. So you guys need to be involved, and you need to change Washington. You need to make Washington be young. I mean, to be updated with what's happening in the world. And I think that today, and this is not just for the U.S. I mean, being from Chile, so I'm fair to speak about the U.S., but we have the same problem. I mean, this political establishment sticks in government forever and ever, and they don't morph. They don't change. And I think that we need, and we have the same problem in the U.S. Only 35% of the available population votes in most of the countries of Latin America where vote is not demanded. In Chile, we used to have, you have to be obliged to vote. I think if you go vote and you participate and you, beyond your ranks, you have new leaders come up, that's going to create the change. If you just wait for Washington the way it is to do changes, you won't see it.
What I find most depressing about students now is their risk aversion. And when I come into a room and I have a greater sense of adventure than they do, that's really sad. And I'm just
your
so
bar is too high.
No, but I'm just gobsmacked by students who really want to know the punchline all the time, and they try to put lipstick on the pig of greed, and I don't believe any of us should strive to be the richest people in the cemetery.
So there are questions again from students. Along these lines, probably having to do with sustainability. This one, what are the panelists' opinions on the waste and excess production or produce products produced by capitalism?
answer that one.
Go ahead.
I'll talk about a couple things on sustainability. One of the companies I work for is a water utility. Some of you may have been at my water panel the other day, but I'm not so worried about the excess product. Our infrastructure is so bad in this country for water that we lose, on average, 27% of produced water, which is our finished product. We lose 27% between the water plant and when it comes out of your tap. So in that sense, I'm not worried about excess product. I'm worried about how do we, you know, get the will and the financing and the determination that we want to rebuild our infrastructure so that we don't have 27% of our good water just being, you know, leaking out of pipes all over the place. So I'm not sure that's what somebody's looking for an answer, but that would be my answer, is I don't know that we have as much excess product in some places as we have lack of investment.
Well, I can tell you on the consumer side, I mean, all the excess product you guys have, all these things you bring back to Goodwill and to Salvation Army, ends up in our countries as being sold by the kilo as used apparel. And probably $2 for the kilo, they buy it and they sell it at 10. So it's a very profitable business in third world countries and undeveloped countries when it comes to apparel. I think when it comes to cars, it's a little more complicated because some countries have put regulations on importation of used cars. But I think, you know, what we most see, I mean, every time you walk into the department stores, because they're not going to sell all this stuff I've seen on the shelf today or in the next year. And somehow it disappears in the next season. So all that stuff ends up in third world countries and being sold by the kilo. So at least from the U.S., it's coming. They're passing the burden to somebody else.
I think it's a great question. And I don't have the answer, but here's a very small data point from Japan. So there's the most popular app in Japan is actually from a Japanese company, Mercari. You can sell your used clothes or used jewelry or whatever on your phone, and it within several hours, 90% of what's put up is sold, and within a day it's shipped to the person. And this is basically a way of sharing, particularly for young ladies, for sharing stuff that they buy dresses or something, wear it a couple of times, get bored with it, and they sell it off and they buy another dress off this app. And it's basically sharing the dresses around to hundreds of people. So it's kind of fun, and it's also an interesting way to consume less and to have less impact on our environment by throwing stuff away like that or sending it to Chile.
thank you very much, because just remind me of that. There was a group of Chilean entrepreneurs that just developed an application also that has been funded now by Google and is trying to be exported outside of Chile. A guy that figured a way to get restaurants and institutional food companies to whatever excess food they have, they published it on this app, and there's a company that goes, collects that food, and brings it to the less benefit people, I mean, unemployed or, you know, especially Salvation Army centers. So this food is not going to waste, it's being recovered, and being taken on time before it gets spoiled and distributed among the poor and the needed. So that app was first passed through a financing from the Chilean government, and then it became a Google awarded app, and now it's being funded by Google.
Great app. So this is again a bit of a departure, but it's I think symbolic of some questions. The question here: talk about the linkage between the need for capitalism to evolve and mature, to support a society, and the need for democracy and governance to evolve.
Let me just take one quick stab at that and talk about actually campaign financing, because I think one of the problems of capitalism as it relates to governance is the fact that because of our rather strange campaign finance, well, unregulated campaign financing rules, you know, people with a lot of money have inordinate influence on policy, and companies will do that. I worked for a very large company which was always one of the top five contributors to congressional campaigns in the country. And we didn't, frankly, really like to do it, but we felt we had no choice but to do it. And because our interests would be, run over by somebody else who would do it. So I think, that's one of the weaknesses that we have in our capitalism system, particularly as it relates to democracy and government, is if we could find a way constitutionally, or that would pass Supreme Court, judgment, to go back to a reasonable campaign financing system, that would be, I think, a big help.
There, so many of the questions have to do with, if I can take the liberty of paraphrasing, of the issues of capitalism and ethics and social responsibility and so forth. Here's one that I think is very representative. It sounds like most of the panel thinks there is too much regulation. Do you have ideas for influencing us all to act with more morality and ethics in our economic lives?
What have your parents been doing?
What do you mean?
Well, I'm not gonna sit up here and tell students how to be good people. They should know that already. I really mean that. People have moral compasses. People know right from wrong. Don't play dumb and do the right thing.
I think, Larry, the comment you made about campaign finance is a good example where more regulation might be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, the premise of the question, a lot of us have said that there is definitely a need for regulation in lots of different areas. And so, Peter, I guess I would not disagree, obviously, because people need to be ethical. But I think, for example, I don't think that we should be abandoning environmental regulations because we expect that that CEOs are going to be ethical about it. So they need to be regulated. And I mentioned this earlier. I think we do have to be careful about putting too much onto the corporation. I mean, the pressures on a CEO of a corporation are huge. I mean, he's got shareholders. I mean, he has. Many people have to choose between doing something ethical and losing their jobs, and an ethical person will lose his job, and that should happen. That's true, but we can't count on it happening, because investors want return on investment, and that's what a corporation is set up to do. And if the corporation doesn't return an adequate return, they will fire the CEO and the management, and that's the way capitalism works. And so, if you want to have checks on that, you have to have regulation.
I think to your point, basically, I think that we all know what's right and wrong, and really, we can't really evade reality. I mean, we can all evade reality, but what we cannot avoid is the consequence of evading reality. And I think that at the end, that's what all matters. I think we all know when something is right and what's wrong.
Having lived in China, I'm speaking as a parent now. Having lived in China and lived through pollution there. By the way, this has nothing to do with Chinese pollution. And there would be rules about the particulates. So if it was over 250, my children were not allowed out of school to play in the playground that day. And it was seen that 250 became a great number. By the time we left, it was regularly over 600. So I would maintain that Xi Jinping now, who is running China, if he has children or grandchildren, does not want his children to have bad lungs. If somebody who's rich lives in Flint, Michigan, they don't want their children to get lead poisoning. So what's the deal here? I mean, if you get it out of the boardroom and get it down to the looking at a sick child, there has to be impact, and it has to inform the way grown-ups behave.
Don't want to totally disagree, but in Flint, Michigan, there probably aren't any particularly wealthy people.
Oh, well.
That's part of the problem.
It should be gentrified.
Should be. Sadly enough, again, I told this story. This is a little off, but since we bring up Flint, there was something that could have been done that would have cost approximately 0.01 cents a gallon, and the decision was made not to do it, which would have been putting an anti-corrosive into the pipes, and they would not have had a problem. And beyond that, they wouldn't have to spend hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, to replace all the pipes. But that's a penny-wise, pound-foolish decision. and they were in financial difficulty, the town, and they made that decision.
The town council?
I think it was the mayor and the town council, yeah. At the recommendation of the water company.
Great.
Because it was cheaper.
We also have a category of questions. I'll read a couple, but in the broad encapsulation. For example, could American capitalism evolve to a steady state, no growth economy? Can the planet continue to sustain unending growth? Another version of that, would the panelists care to speak to the notion of regenerative economy? And then there are others as well. Can we open that one up?
Booms and busts. I don't know that there's such a thing as a steady state economy, and maybe it was more so when we weren't so interconnected with the rest of the world. But I don't see how you can, again, you can temper the booms and the busts, but I just don't see that going away. Because a lot of it is human nature. You know, everybody gets all hepped up about stock markets going through the roof, and then poof. It hits a bump. I don't want to be flip about it, but I just don't think a steady state economy is. I mean, you're the economist, Larry. You probably have a better sense of whether that's feasible.
No, I think you're right. I mean, but you'll see, ups and downs. But I think what's interesting, though, on that question, and my experience in Japan, is bringing me to this kind of realizations is that we are actually seeing a decline in the overall growth of the world economy. So a lot of people are looking at that as a bad thing, right? So people here in America say, oh, we were growing so well in the 80s and growing so well in the 60s, and we're going to make America great again by growing it in 4%, just to take a term, and by having it grow again by 4%. But in fact, it's not necessarily a bad thing for a mature economy that's not really growing our population that fast, although we are, of course, still growing our population. To have, two to three percent is fine, and we've seen this around the world. Now the U.S. is still growing because we have immigration, which is a good thing, but for native-born Americans, fertility is going down, and we're actually not growing. That's not a bad thing, and Japan is actually now shrinking. Right, it's shrinking on a secular basis. Every day there's fewer Japanese than there were yesterday. In 30 years, there'll be 85 million versus 127 million Japanese today. That's not a terrible thing. Actually, that's not for the Earth. That's maybe a pretty good thing. And that happens because when people become wealthier, they have fewer children. And we're seeing it in China. We're seeing it in Japan, Italy, Korea. It's happening around the world. So maybe we're heading to a good place. And the question is, and this is the problem, is that the world has never done that, so this is the first time that we're going to be doing this slowing down, right? And eventually even shrinking. And there's lots of challenges that go with that. Japan is actually dealing with those challenges today, so they're the laboratory for this phenomenon that I believe will be a worldwide phenomenon of shrinking at some point in 30, 50, 60 years maybe. About how you do that, how you take care of the older people when you have fewer younger people, how do you care of debt problems when you have a high debt that needs to get paid off. I mean, there's lots of issues that need to be dealt with, but I think they're manageable. So I think actually we may be seeing an interesting development here that actually will lead to a more sustainable Earth.
I think what Larry is talking about points up a really interesting issue. When I went to the talk by the futurist in Mackey a couple of days ago, all he talked about was cars and machines. I would have liked to hear about the long view of the way humanity was going. What were the quantum leaps that were awaiting us? What really can we think about besides machinery, besides hardware, software? What's going to happen to populations? That's all worthy of thought, but futurists aren't thinking about animate objects these days.
I'm overwhelmed by the number of questions here, as you can tell.
Great, that's good.
Depends what they are.
At least people are engaged.
There are several questions about both the implications, perhaps the risks of fintech, am I pronouncing that correctly? Technology and
financial transactions and so forth, and some specifically to the advent of blockchain technologies and cryptocurrencies and so forth. Would the panelists care to comment on that, please?
Well, I can comment on it. I'm just not clear what the question is.
Well, they're short questions, and there's an expression of general concern about fintech,
okay,
the implications of technology in financial markets and so forth, I expect,
okay,
well, as leading to risks.
I mean, blockchain, again, I'll come back to what I said a few minutes ago. Blockchain is a technology. It can be used for good or bad. A lot of people conflate Bitcoin with blockchain because they hear about them in the same sentence. They are not the same thing. In fact, blockchain, although it's still, there's a lot of struggle among the financial services companies, and there's an association that's been put together to develop blockchain and figure out good applications for it. It's still, they haven't quite figured out what to do with it. But it's potentially a very attractive technology. Again, most people don't know what blockchain is. Blockchain is basically a ledger system or an accounting system that can track a transaction. It's immutable. Once the transaction is completed and it's done, it's completed by being verified by several peer computers. And then when they finish several transactions, they put them in a block, which is where block comes, and then they put them together with other blocks, which is the chain. And it's a really interesting technology and may well have particularly interesting applicability, particularly for financial services institutions. On the other hand, it's a real threat to financial institutions because financial services institutions have historically been the intermediaries. If you think about your checkbook or your credit card or whatever, the blockchain can potentially develop a system where you don't have to use a credit card or a checking account. It's a peer-to-peer transaction. You know, you can go to the guy on the street with the food cart, and you can do your transaction through a blockchain transaction. Not now, but potentially in the future. So it has huge implications for the operational side of the payments systems, whether it's financial services or people like Apple and Google and others who are getting into the payment system business. But some of those same financial institutions are also trying to figure out how they can utilize it in their businesses so they don't get cut out of the business. So it's a very interesting technology, and Bitcoin aside, that's a whole different subject. But the technology of blockchain is quite interesting and has some really good potential. I don't know if that answered the question somebody was asking, but
I mean, people forge checks. So good people don't forge checks and bad people forge checks. So I think there's a whole dark side to what Martha's talking about, but that doesn't mean it can't be used in the sunshine.
So here's another question from a student, very specifically to a question having to do with China. Will China modify their practices in order to be a fair trading partner, and especially in terms of intellectual property?
Not unless they're forced to do it. And I think if we continue to simply remain obsessed with bauxite and aluminum, it ain't going to do the job. I think we have to find a way of dealing with the issue. And I think it's also worth remembering that it's the corporations that give away intellectual property to do business in China. So many corporations make deals with the devil. So this has to be thought through. But I don't think we should thrash around in this country willy-nilly trying to make America great again and ending up with the opposite. And I don't think that's going to accomplish this goal with China.
You know, the question does actually relate to the capitalism discussion as well, because, you know, China has this thing they call this capitalism with social characteristics. Did I get that right, Peter?
Yeah.
And that's on the continuum that we talked about, very much on the state-governed and state-driven side. And so there's some, in addition to kind of foreign pressure on China to do the right thing, there's also internal pressure in China, because there is a school of thought that having a state-driven, industrial policy with the SOEs playing a large role and stealing intellectual property as opposed to developing it yourself is actually not going to be helpful for China to become an innovative, dynamic economy that it wants to be. So, you know, there's forces both within China and outside of China that are pressing for change here. It's just the question of whether those pressure is going to be strong enough to get change.
I'm going to perhaps end with this question. There are many, many questions that are, some are very harsh in the sense of being critical of past failings of capitalism. And this question states the following. All the panelists are such defenders of capitalism, it's hard to figure out what to ask. Here, try this. Can capitalism ever succeed without taking advantage of the weak or the earth as it always does?
So who says I'm a capitalist? I think capitalism, I think the fatal word here was always. Could you reread the question?
Starting out with all the panelists?
Right at the end you said, capitalism always is abusive or always whatever it was. I object to that as a non-capitalist.
Yeah, I just go back to what I said earlier. I mean, I am a defender of capitalism because I think it's better than, it's a little bit like I think actually Bob Kaufman said this the other day, it's like democracy being a terrible system except it's better than everything else. I mean, it's messy, but it's better than other systems of organizing our economy that we've seen so far. But the question is, what kind of capitalism do you want? I mean, obviously protecting the weak is something that every society believes in doing, but you do that by, you know, I would say a capitalist system allows you to fire a worker who isn't doing his or her job. But then if that person's on the street, it's up to the government and you use using taxpayer money to help that person out. But we shouldn't require companies to hire people who can't do their jobs. And that's the difference, frankly, between American capitalism and socialism or even, in a sense, Japanese capitalism.
Well, I think that, you know, Latin America, we're an example of all these tryouts. And we're continually experiment. So, you know, obviously Venezuela is an example where no longer capitalist. I invite any of you all to go to Venezuela and spend one day there. So, you know, having lived both, I think that, as I said, you know, capitalism with a social responsibility side as a social market economy allows for this to be tamed. But I think, and that's really what we need. We need a government that's strong enough to support the weak and give them the chances to succeed and become capitalists themselves.
I lived in China for a long time. I went there first in 1978, and then I lived there from 82 to 85, and then went back from 2007 to 2010. I saw really terrible things. I arrived there right at the end of the Cultural Revolution. It was a heartbreaking situation. The Chinese are very good at killing each other. So are the Russians under the old system, and certainly they're pretty good at it in the new system. but I really would urge you, and I have to confess this, as depressed as I am about America today, I refuse to give up.
Thank you for that statement. I'm going to suggest that we wrap up here in a minute with the hopes that by allowing a little extra time, there may be some availability for panelists to answer individual questions. I have to say I would also thoroughly enjoy an evening with this group and an open-ended forum of debate and dialogue. This has been really marvelous, and the quality of the questions reflect that. I would also be remiss if I were not to read, before we turn to audience questions, I forgot that, we would like to quickly mention that the CWA 70th crowdfunding campaign, we have set a goal to raise $70,000. We're a quarter of the way there, and you can give by selecting the donate button on any of several sites, I'm sure. I want the record to reflect that I did not totally forget that comment. And with that, I thank you all.
Capitalist pig.